to Inside Scoop Live. Hi, I'm Irene Watson. I'm your host for today. And are you ever in for a great treat today? I am delighted to be speaking to Arthur M. Mills, Jr. He's the author of The Empty Lot Next Door, and we're talking on the phone from he's all the way in Korea. The story is based on true events that happened in and around his home in South Austin, Texas, when he was a child. And today we're really going to delve into some of his experiences with a ghost that kept haunting him over the years. But first, just a little bit about Art Mills. He was born and raised in Austin, Texas, and is now living in Korea. He and his wife, Yosan, have two children, Arthur and Alan. He joined the Army shortly after high school and has been serving honorably ever since then. Hi, Art.
Hi, how are you?
Good. I'm so glad to be talking to you, and it's a real pleasure to be talking from somebody that's all the way from Korea and definitely someone that's serving in our military and doing such great work for us. Thank you so much for everything that you do.
Well, thank you. Thanks for having me today.
Well, this is going to be really fun, and I just want to tell the readers that I have read this book, and I tell you, I put it down and I sat there. And the haunting started, and it haunted me that afternoon, the next day, and into the following day, because there's just so much that is in this book that it could be haunting. And I had a lot of questions because of my psychology background, and also that at one time in my lifetime I was doing ghost busting. It just really, really got to me. And I'm sure that there are other readers that felt the same way. Have you had comments, Art?
Most of the comments I had was, well, there were mostly questions. They were asking me if it was real.
Uh-huh.
They'll say, did this really happen? And then after that, they have to tell me their own ghost story.
Right.
But the main question really, everybody always asked me after they read it or after they heard me explain the story was, did it really happen?
So I'm sure that our listeners are wondering, did this really happen?
Got to read the book. but truthfully, though, when I was growing up, that was the question I had for myself. Did it really happen? I like to think that I'm a reasonable person and that I think things through. And even at the tender age of 7 to 11 years old, I was wondering if it was really true. I mean, could there really be ghosts? And did she really, the girl that I nicknamed Candleface, that rumored to have died in the fire next door, did she really live, and was she really buried in that empty lot? And it just didn't make sense. So as I grew up, I wondered myself. And so for many years, as I told the story, people would ask me if it was true, and I said yes.
Mm-hmm.
But deep down, I wondered if it was really true. And part of the book was a way for me to answer that question myself. So originally, that book was not even meant to be a book. It was just me sitting down and researching, just trying to put the pieces together myself. And as I put the pieces together, when I started to determining whether it was real or not, was it really just an 11-year-old kid just imagining things, or did it really happen? So really, it was very therapeutic for me to research it and then put it into a story.
And I can understand that. It certainly would answer a lot of your questions. Well, you know, then, as I say, I've read the book, so there's certainly a lot of evidence pointing that it was real because you actually experienced, you saw the palm print, there were rips on the screen. You yourself had scratches that on your body when you experienced her scratching you, and there was actually blood. So, you know, those are real.
Right. The reason at the time when I was between 7 to 11 years old that I questioned if it was Candleface that was doing the scratches on my body,
mm-hmm.
was there was a few times that my brother Felix would do the very same thing as a joke, because I'm the younger brother, I'm the youngest of four. He would climb on top of me and poke me in the chest repeatedly while I was blue. And so when I would wake up and I had the same thing where Candleface was doing it, and then I woke up and would see blue marks on my chest. I wondered, did my brother do that to me while I was asleep, or did I pass out and I couldn't remember? Or maybe I was just doing it to myself. So there were so many different things that was going on that I just wasn't sure if it happened. And those, that question, did it really occur, went throughout my whole life until I actually sat down and started doing the research.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, when a child is 7 to 11 and you have sons yourself, they do have a vivid imagination, but also there's been research that has been done that they actually do see more than what we as adults do because, but it's, you know, we grow up and we start questioning and then we start closing up. So, as you know, the research does point that a child can see on another realm. But also, Art, there were others that saw ghosts as well. It wasn't only you.
Right.
And so that certainly probably answers some questions for them, too. So as I read the book, what I really got from it, too, that your parents were really emotionally absent. Looking back now, as you as an adult and as a father, what does that look like to you now and what you had to go through with the emotionally absent parents?
Growing up, I do remember my brother Richard showing signs of stress, showing signs of sinking into himself prior to him committing suicide. And I saw the signs, and so did my mother, and so did my father and my brothers. We all saw it, but we just didn't say anything. We just didn't know what to do. It's not like today where schools and other programs are actually teaching people what the signs look like. Mm-hmm. But back then, we just didn't know. And now looking back, now I'm a parent. I'm always watching my kids, looking for any particular signs. I do have one son, Alan, that tends to be very introverted and actually seems to have a lot of the same characteristics as my brother Richard. Mm-hmm. So I tend to want to watch him and probably even maybe them more than what I should. But I think parents need to actually monitor their kids more, and I think they do that these days more than they did in the 70s and then throughout the 80s.
Oh, definitely. And there's just so much more information. And not only that, but also therapy is available and, you know, the research that has been done and what causes these issues in kids. And, of course, there's all, as you say, you know, people watch their kids more because there's just so much more information. And I think at that time, and I'm thinking of my own childhood, too, that because of the not knowing, it was just easier to back away from it or emotionally get closed off and hope it goes away.
Right.
Which it doesn't. Art, you mentioned your brother and that he committed suicide, and I'd just like to talk a little bit about that. You and your brother, Ray, no, you were Ray, pardon me. You were called
right.
Ray when
yeah.
you were, right, Richard is the brother's name.
Right.
Very close in a sense. And so there was that special bonding. And I guess it's because also that you had two other brothers that were much older, and then there was the two of you. And so you go through in your book a lot about how you felt. And I'd like you to just tell the listeners how that bond was really occurring between you and your brother Richard before he committed suicide.
Well, one, I would say we had a common enemy, our older brothers.
Yes.
And they were between 4 or 6 years older than us. And, you know, as an adult, that doesn't really matter. But when you're very young, that's a big difference. And they were, at the time, really into alcohol and drugs, even at their young ages themselves. And they actually saw my brother Richard and I as family punching bags. And they really did beat us quite often. But my brother Richard got most of it, mostly because he just did not fight back. And he was a very religious person, and he would always quote, "Jesus says to turn the other cheek." And so my brothers would hit him on the other cheek, or the bullies would hit him on the other cheek. And he just wouldn't even raise his hand to block the blows or even blink. He just accepted it. And for me, I would fight back or at least defend myself as much as I could. And that usually stopped my brothers from hitting me.
Mm-hmm.
I would raise my hand or lift or sit down on the floor and lift my legs to kick if they approached me. And I noticed that is what prevented them from coming after me, just because I was trying to defend myself. But my brother Richard just wouldn't do it, and then that is what brought them to him to fight. And I would tell my brother Richard, you should defend yourself. You need to do something. And he would say, no, I just need Jesus. I just need to pray. And I kept saying, well, I don't think that's what Jesus is really saying. And he would stick to that. And I think him not defending himself is what really drew him, drew the bullies to him. And Richard and I would talk, but I would never talk to him about my dreams and my dealings with Candleface, because just like I was trying to tell Richard to fight back, I wasn't fighting back Candleface.
Mm-hmm.
And she kept coming after me. So I was very hypocritical. I was telling my brother to fight while I wasn't doing it myself. I don't get much detail in Richard and I's bond, but we did have a rather unspoken bond. There were many times when I would have different feelings, or maybe I thought that I would see Candleface, even though that Richard and I were sitting together watching TV, and I would look up at one of the windows where I would think she would be crawling through. I would hear the sounds coming through the window, and my brother Richard would quickly look up at the window and look my way and give a little snicker as if he knew what was going to happen. But he would never say anything to me about it, and I would never say anything to him about it. We just both knew what was going on. And there was a particular time in the creek when my brother was getting beat up by Carlos, the neighborhood bully, where looking up, I saw cloud formations that looked like her Candleface's face. Of course, you know, you could always look up at a cloud and your imagination can form anything. But Richard and I looked up and we saw, well, I suspect that we saw the same things. We were looking at the exact same place at the exact same time. So the bond that we had was typical 11, 12-year-old. You know, we did have our rivalries. We did fight. But we also had the understanding that something was happening to both of us. But to this day, I still wonder, why couldn't we talk together to each other? Why couldn't we ask for outside help?
Well, you know, as you had mentioned earlier, it was the times, and really, who do you ask? Your parents were emotionally absent, and so it would be difficult to ask them. And then, you know, if you talk to somebody else, there's always that fear of being ridiculed, because you certainly were ridiculed by your older brothers. And so I'm sure it was very difficult to even consider talking to somebody else. You, your brother, he committed suicide at 12. Is that correct?
Right.
That's pretty young to really, you know, be in such a place that the only reason, the only way that he felt out is to commit suicide. And now as an adult looking back, what did you do you see that really led him to that place?
Now, what place are you talking about?
What led him to the place of having to commit suicide, that he felt the only way out is to commit suicide?
My brother Richard was the one that a lot of the bullies went to. You know, they knew that it would be an easy fight.
Mm-hmm.
He would not fight back. My brothers picked on him too. You know, he did claim that our parents didn't care, and he just felt that he couldn't go anymore. And he did write poetry, and he did write a lot of love and romantic poetry, but throughout the months leading to his death, his poetry turned very dark. And it was about the environment, how humans were destroying the environment, and nobody was doing anything to fix it. And he just didn't want to live in such a world. And it's sad to say that I even at times ridiculed him for such writings. You know, I'll tell him that he's so talented, he should write about better things, not such dark things. And he just felt that was his way of expressing his feelings. But we did build him because he was such a good actor. He loved to get up and tell stories and write pouring poems and write his own stories. We built him a treehouse in the biggest tree in that empty lot.
Mm-hmm.
And it had a second floor. It even had a stage, and he would get up there and perform while we all sat down on the bottom and watched him. And eventually he stopped going to that treehouse, and he actually started to tear it down board by board. And we were all dumbfounded, like, why in the world would he do that? That was his oyster. That was where he would go to feel at ease. And then when he committed suicide, that one board that he left there, that branch from one branch to the other, that's the one that he put the rope around and around his neck and hung himself. So it still matches that tree was his place where he felt at ease.
Yeah.
And I think by him committing suicide, that was him letting himself be at peace or be at ease, as a twisted way that is. But to a 12-year-old child that is in so much pain, that is how he felt to be peace.
And we'll be back with more Inside Scoop Live after these important announcements.
Inside Scoop Live is a global internet-based broadcast specializing in interviewing published authors about their current books and areas of expertise. I'm Juanita Watson, the host of the show, and invite you to join me as I bring to the air both well-known and upcoming writers. You will hear my guests talk candidly about their books, their life experience, specific topics, and the business of being an author in today's literary world. Always interesting and current, my intention is to bring our audience high-quality discussions that spotlight a vast diversity of authors in the field today. Our interviews are syndicated and archived for availability 24/7 through direct podcast and MP3 download. And as always, I love to hear from listeners. Have a look at our website, InsideScoopLive.com. Send me an email, comment on previous guests, and let me know who you'd like to hear on the show. I'll do my best to bring you your favorite authors live and direct.
Welcome back to Inside Scoop Live. We're speaking today with Art Mills, author of The Empty Lot Next Door. So what do you think? Or its experience is real? I'll let you decide for yourself. So listen on. So now as an adult, you can look at this and, you know, you can rationalize and understand. But you, at that time, how old were you at the time that he committed suicide?
I was 11.
11 years old. You're just a year younger than him.
Right.
What was going on within you? What emotional state were you in at that time? Did you also feel that nobody was caring?
I did at the time.
Mm-hmm.
And as I got older, I started realizing that was not the case. I know I beat up my brothers and I beat up my mother and father. But it is important to say that I don't blame them. I don't blame anybody.
Mm-hmm.
I do say, though, my brother Richard should have been able to reach out, and somebody should have been out there to see the change, see the warning signs. But looking back, I don't say my mother was a bad mother or my father. I don't say that at all. Mm-hmm. And I have a lot of feedback saying that I'm really bad in the sense of treating my mother bad, and that's not the case. I wrote it as if I was 11 years old,
exactly.
And I wrote it as how I saw it at the time.
And what I want to say is to our listeners is that's the perspective that is coming through in your book, is that even the writing resembles the thoughts and emotions of this 11-year-old, and I did not get out of your book that you were beating up your mother or your parents at all, but you were stating the fact is what was happening at that time. But what I did get out of it was that she was emotionally absent, which, you know, she was. But that doesn't make her a bad person.
Right.
She was doing the best that she could, and under the circumstances, you know, from what you write in your book, they were working people, and they had spent a lot of time working to in order to make enough money to live, basically. So there's certainly, I didn't get at all that they were bad-mouthing or anything like that. I want to say, I'll tell our listeners that I live in Austin, so this, of course, gave me the opportunity to explore this a little further. And I, along with my friend and her son, and my husband and our granddaughter, went to the street. And I was surprised that actually the street ends up, I think, is only like one block long. It was a short street.
Right, very short.
Very short. And we did walk it from one end to the other. And we had an interesting experience because we were walking. We parked at one end. We walked to the other end, and we saw where the house is. Still remains, and we could see the tree. And of course, we went at night, you know, because it's a ghost story, and so we wanted to get that whole experience. And so we walked to one end where the telephone company is, and then we walked back to the other. And as we were walking, and we all of us, turned around at the same time, and there was a girl dressed in white walking down the street, maybe 30 feet behind us. And we all just kind of stood and looked at each other, and we turned and then she just kind of disappeared. And so it was an interesting experience that we had because, and we just all looked at each other. There she was, and then she was gone again. Where did she come from? Where did she go? And so was she a ghost or was she a real person that just happened to come out of one house and go into another? We don't know.
Wow.
So we certainly did have an experience there. And I, and as I say, you know, when I read the book, it just haunted me for a few days because of the experience you as a child had, whether it was real or if it was in your mind, was very traumatic. And you certainly did go through a lot of traumatic experiences within yourself because of candle faith. And so
right.
Do a lot of these emotions, when you talk about it or you reflect back to when it was happening, are they still there?
They're still there, but not as I was a child. They've actually transformed into me being an adult. And I did mention that I tend to pamper my kids too much. I do notice sometimes I will say something or do something that they don't like, and, you know, of course, they pout. You know, I'm talking about when they were a little younger. And I would think, would they, if they get to the point of being so sad, would they even commit suicide?
Yeah.
So I tend to try to smooth things over, and then at the same time I'm realizing that if I smooth things over, that's even causing trouble in the future.
Yeah.
That I can't keep baiting them, but at the same time, I don't want them to fall into the same predicament, because suicide tends to fall in my family. There's not just my brother Richard, but my real father, because the one in the book is my stepfather, but my real father committed suicide. And it not just that, but there were several others on the same street that I lived on, and within the neighborhood and within the elementary school.
That's right. So, that was the next thing I was going to talk about, is because for this little street that's just basically a block long, there were, in your neighborhood, there were a lot of deaths and suicides.
Right.
And so it just, it amazes me. So you were actually, you were in the center of all that death that was going around you. And,
right, yeah.
You know, and of course then candle face showing up, and that must have been very traumatic for a child that, you know, 7 to 11.
Right. There were several deaths that occurred on the street, and it wasn't just my brother Richard. I could at least count four others, and after talking to friends that still live in the neighborhood, the deaths just didn't stop after I moved. They did continue, but while I was there, I would actually have dreams actually and informed by Candleface that the death would occur. Just like I did have a dream of Candleface putting a belt around my neck, telling me that this was my brother Richard's favorite, and as she tightens it around my neck, she's keep pointing to him, and then the very next day is when my brother hung himself. I've had dreams or Candleface really coming to me, telling me, having a race car in her hand and a G.I. Joe figure hitting them together, interacting a death that occurred just that day. I've had dreams of her putting her hand in the shape of a revolver, putting it to my head and shooting it, pretending like she's shooting me in the head. And the very next day, there was an older individual that lived up the street that shot himself in the head. So I kept having these visions or these dreams, furthering my suspicion that she was involved in death.
Mm-hmm. This is, for another word, I'm not sure what to call her, a ghost. She was an angry ghost. A lot of times from my research and what I understand is a lot of the ghosts that are, you know, on this plane are left here and they didn't transition to the light and all these, you know, there's different belief systems. And quite often if you allow them, if you work with them and allow them to go, they will go to the light and not be present here on this earth plane. But she seemed to be a little different than any of the ones that, you know, I've encountered or know about. She was angry, and she was really stuck on this earth plane. So it's interesting that she chose you to be that conduit and give you those precognition dreams. And, you know, and we're going to assume that she was real. It's interesting that she chose you. Do you have any thoughts as why you were the one and not somebody else?
I don't think she chose me. I chose her.
Interesting.
Because it was rumors. I'm the new kid in the block. I'm going back to age 7 or 8.
Mm-hmm.
You still had this empty lot, and I'm asking my friends that have already been there in the neighborhood for countless years, why is this an empty lot? Why is there this space here? And they would always just force laugh the question away.
Mm-hmm.
And eventually they answered, and it was a friend of mine, Randy, that says there was a house there, the house burnt down, and a family of 4 were killed. They could not afford cemetery plots, so the family of the deceased actually just buried them in the backyard. And being 7 years old, yes, I believed it to the most part. And they did say that at night these ghosts will come up and haunt the neighborhood, but if anybody were to jump in this hole that was located in the backyard, if you were to jump in there, the ghost will come out of the hole and kill you. Didn't quite believe that, but later that night, I had to test it. I had to see if it was true. And I went there in the middle of the night, and I eventually jumped into that hole to see if the ghost would come out. And they didn't come out, and I was mocking the ghost. I was jumping up and down, poking the bottom of the hole that was just 3 feet deep,
mm-hmm.
poking it, saying, "Where are you? Come out. Come out if you're real." Nothing came out. So I ended up going back home feeling like I just spelled a nasty rumor that now I'm the wisest person in the world, that I now can outdo my brother and my friends. I know something they don't know. But it was that night, later on that night, is when I first saw her. So I think I chose her in the sense that if I didn't jump in that hole, she would have just remained. And so I provoked her. I picked a fight with her. I told her to show herself. And so she came out to seek revenge. But why did she not kill me, as I suspected she killed the others?
The others.
I think maybe I was just a toy for her.
Mm-hmm.
I think that there's, in the wild, you got killer whales that like to play with dolphins or sea lions. They throw them in the air. Maybe that's what she was doing to me. I was just her toy.
Yeah, very possible, very possible. It's interesting that when we went there on that street to find that there actually is a house now on the empty lot next door, and, of course, where the hole was and where your experiences were with Candle Faith. And so it would be interesting to know what is really going on in that home. You know, does she appear to them? Are there some weird stuff going on, do you know? Have you talked to anybody in the area?
I would love to know that myself. I haven't talked to anybody, or I haven't talked to the residences there. I did, the last time I was in Austin was 2007, and I drove by and I did notice that there was a house there.
Yes.
And I didn't want to bother anybody. So I did acquire some information from Randy that still lives in the house that he lived all his life.
Mm-hmm.
And he did tell me that they did know about the suicide in their backyard. And they did know about the house burning down, but they didn't really have much details.
Mm-hmm.
So I did ask him to go to the libraries to do as much research about that particular house before it burnt down. But I don't know how much really the new owners know.
Mm-hmm.
I would like to, next time I'm in Austin, to stop by and talk to them.
Mm-hmm.
I did send them a copy of the book, the letter explaining why I wrote it.
Uh-huh.
And even the house that I lived in next door, I sent them a book.
Uh-huh.
It was about 6 weeks ago, and I haven't heard anything back from them.
Anything back? Well, it'll be interesting to hear what really is going on there, if anything. So this has been just a really, really interesting conversation, and I'm really glad that we were able to talk to you, and, you know, being all the way from Korea just makes it a little bit more interesting. And not only that, I'm here in Austin, and I read the book and even went to visit the street to see what I could pick up. So it's been a real pleasure talking to you. And is there anything that you want to say to our listening audience before we close up here?
The main point of this book is not the haunted house, or the my visions of Candleface, really. It's really centered on communication within a family. As weird as that sounds, I know it's really a ghost story, but I did have a brother that committed suicide, and that is always going to haunt me. I'm over the Candleface part, but now I have the haunting that I could have prevented that suicide. I could have prevented it, and so could have my brothers or my parents, if they knew what to do.
Mm-hmm.
Several years ago, I had a soldier tell me that just wanted to end it, that he just had a nasty divorce, and he just didn't want to go any further. And the first thing I did is I went to our boss, and I told on him. I said, this guy just told me he wanted to commit suicide.
Mm-hmm.
And the Army got him help and actually had his father move to the local area and took care of him. So when the soldier actually got out of the Army, at his ceremony, he actually told me that I saved his life.
Wow.
And if I did not get that help for him,
mm-hmm.
he may have actually committed suicide. And so if I can get people out there to actually see the errors of our ways,
mm-hmm.
maybe they could prevent suicides today, because they're happening all the time.
Yeah.
There's a lot of high-level, big cases of suicides, people being picked on the Internet even.
Yeah.
And if we could just get the word out and get people, let people know what to look out for, maybe we could prevent suicides.
And you know, Art, I have to concur with you, and that's what really I got out of the book, too, was that it is that communication within the family, and that came really strong throughout the book, but that's really, you know, if that would have happened, there could have been a lot of different changes. And of course, the ghost part is really, you know, is a really good addition, because it really shows that the child, you, between 7 and 11, had these experiences. And really, when you think about it, that could have led you to a suicide as well, but
right.
It didn't. And so, you know, There we go. So, Art, tell our real listening audience your website address so they can find out more information about you and the book.
It's www.theemptylotnextdoor.com. No spaces.
Theemptylotnextdoor.com.
Right.
It's the title of the book. And as we're talking with Art Mills, he's the author, and he's really giving us a lot of. It's a really interesting book, and I just don't know what else to say about it because, as I say, I've read it. It haunted me. There were a lot of things that haunted me, and it wasn't really the ghost part of it. It was just so many other things in it, and I encourage listeners to really check this book out. And specifically, if you are living in Austin, Texas, or in the central area of Texas, check this book out because it really kind of hits home. And it's in our area. This happened in our area. Gosh, Art, thank you so much. Thank you so much. This is an important book that you have written, not only for yourself, I'm sure it was very cathartic, but also for others to read and, as you say, you know, shift their perspective and also look at the communication that's going on within your own family. Possibly there's just something that you aren't seeing for some reason or another, and I know that by reading this book, it may just trigger being able to see. Mm-hmm. Thank you again, Art, and I really appreciate talking to you, and I hope to meet you when you're in Austin next time.
Yes, I'm actually looking forward to it, and thank you so much for having me.
And thank you. And there you go, listeners. This is Irene Watson with Inside Scoop Live. Thanks for listening, and I do encourage you to check out this book. It's called The Empty Lot Next Door by Arthur M. Mills, Jr. It's a winner.